www.thebeatles.com.
Hello and welcome back to Shattering This. I'm your host, Yadam. A couple of issues from our guest, who, by the way, I thought you did a marvelous job. It's always a pleasure to speak with anyone who has studied the material so that he has a complete grasp on the evidence, and then someone who can process that evidence in a reasonable and rational way and isn't afraid to articulate what they have found. For those who would like to read Kenneth Roberts' articles, the website is politicalislam.com, politicalislam.com, and he writes under the name Kenneth Roberts. The founder of that website is somebody we will also have on this program in future days. We are also corresponding now by email. But there are very few things that I can devote time to on this program that have more value to you long term, at least in the first hour where we consider the news, than exposing the true nature of Islam. Because Islam is responsible not only for 99% of the terrorist acts perpetrated on the world today, it not only has 1.5 billion people abused by this religion, living in hellish conditions, it is also the religion that Yahweh tells us will be responsible for starting World War III and for creating a war in which one half of the Earth's population is ultimately going to die. And so the more you know about this religion, the better job you can do of protecting those you love, the more moral you can be in trying to free people from this calamity of morality. And also, as I found when I studied Islam, is the better you come to understand Muhammad and his wannabe God, Allah, the better you come to know the true nature of the adversary of Hasatan. And once you know the tactics that are deployed by Hasatan and his messengers, like Paul, for example, the more readily you are put in a position where you can understand how they have gone about and why they have gone about corrupting Yahweh's message, how religions are conceived in general, how they are promoted. And so it's a extraordinarily valuable exercise for us, which is why I look forward to having Kenneth Roberts back on the program, as well as the founder of the politicalislam.com website. One last bookkeeping issue. Even though everything that Kenneth Roberts had to say was precisely accurate as it relates to Islam, he did make a parting comment which was inaccurate. And since we're here to shatter myths, I do want to correct the comment that was inaccurate. Lincoln had no part in freeing slaves. Now, I don't expect Kenneth Roberts, who has devoted countless hours of his life to researching Islam, to be an expert on everything. That would be unreasonable to as an expectation. But here's the truth. Lincoln was a racist. Lincoln had no interest in freeing slaves. Lincoln didn't free a single slave. The myth that is Lincoln is the entire myth that transforms politics into religion. As we learned, Lincoln wanted to keep African Americans from associating with white people, and he declared that they were forever inferior and needed to be ruled over by white people and then segregated from them.
He's a documented racist. They have
correct.
They have speeches by him. That,
right.
Like, if you read his speeches from when he was campaigning to get into the Senate
right.
and become in that,
yes.
he is a documented racist.
The Lincoln-Douglas debates.
Yep, the Lincoln-Douglas debates. I believe at one point he said that I have no interest in the equality of of the races, as I feel that one race should always be superior to the other.
Absolutely. Direct quote.
Yeah.
Correct. We have created this myth because In America, we want to make our politics a religious zeal so that there is this blind patriotism. And so Lincoln becomes the founder of the American religion. And it's his shrine and his speeches that become the scripture and the temple of the American religion. And as is the case with the founder of every religion, is a complete fraud. And we need to know that. So you're right, Scott. So those are the bookkeeping issues. That does not in any way diminish my enthusiasm for Kenneth Roberts. He is right that the world would benefit from someone who was in a position of authority, of power, of influence, who had a conscience, who was well-educated, who was rational, who would speak out against the nature of the religion of Islam so as to free its captives. It's just that that person ought not model the example of Lincoln. These things known, I do want to turn back to the creation account. It is so essential to our overall understanding of who God is, what he has done, and it's this raging debate, this war of words that has existed between the science and against Yahweh's scriptural testimony is something also worth considering. And that's where we were at the end of our program on Friday. We were considering the scientific position that eliminates the need for a God. You see, if the universe was created out of nothing without cause, simply from a big bang, and that life emerged without cause, simply by random chance, then where does one need a God? Now, as we have already discovered, every aspect of our genesis as it relates to the cosmos was perfectly articulated, accurately articulated by Yahweh, and that his position has remained the same, constant and dependable, for over 3,400 years, while science has just recently come to the same conclusions about the Big Bang, about the universe being created, about it continuing to expand, about the presence of dark energy and inaccessible matter, all of the things that God said were true, about the dominance of life, about matter being nothing but organized energy, about the influence of relativity in terms of the timeline. Everything that God has said, science has now recognized, is true. But so is the issue of the creation of life, which is the point we are now in his testimony. Science would have you believe, and this is the quote that we read from Harvard University biology professor and Nobel laureate George Wald. It says, and this was printed some years ago in Scientific American, however improbable, it's not improbable, it's impossible, we regard the start of all life or of the steps which it involves, given enough time, it will almost certainly happen at least once. By the way, that line and all of the steps which it involves, it's not just about the creation of life. It's about the creation of things like eyes before there was any knowledge that there was something to see. It's about the male and female forms throughout all genre of living animals. It is about this universal code called DNA, which is a language that permeates all life, and it's the same for all life. And so you're dealing with elements here that are improbable, I would say impossible, for spontaneous generation as life itself. And he's trying to sweep both of those two under this same mythical rug. So however improbable we regard the start of all life, or any of the steps which it involves, given enough time, it will almost certainly happen at least once. Now what his deal is that this concept of it happening once with macroevolution is sufficient for all of its permutations, because the concept of macroevolution is that life was conceived once, and from that seed of life, all other complex life forms evolved. Now, of course, that theory is wholly against the second law of thermodynamics. It is wholly against an understanding of the genome where it devolves, disintegrates as opposed to evolving upward. Information is lost and it becomes corrupted over time, not gaining information, becoming more pure, more powerful over time. And you've got also the fossil record, which shows that life in all of its forms came to exist within a cosmic nanosection of time. And so everything he is saying here is designed to sweep under this mythical carpet of time all of the problems that he knows are irresolvable in terms of the creation and continuing thriving of life. So, however improbable we regard the start of all life, or any of the steps which it involves, given enough time, it will almost certainly happen at least once. And for life as we know it, once may be enough. Time is, in fact, the hero of the plot. The time with which we have to deal is in the order of 2 billion years. Now, we know that to be factually inaccurate now. The time which we're dealing with now is in the range maybe of 5 million years, and that's at the extreme end. What we regard as impossible on the basis of human experience is meaningless here. In other words, don't use logic, don't use reason, because if you use logic and reason, you will come to the undeniable conclusion that life did not emerge, nor did it evolve, from random chance. Given so much time, which we now know isn't true, the impossible becomes possible. The possible, probable. The probable, virtually certain. One only has to wait. Time itself performs the miracles, not God. Time. Non-existent time, as we find out. And, by the way, just because when something is impossible, it does not change and become possible just because you play the game over and over again. The singular basis of his assertion, actually his statement of faith, is false, rendering his conclusion false. Now, in our program on Friday, we examined what Scientific American had to say, printing a retraction of a Nobel laureate's claim as its lead article. We'll review that and then move on with the problem science has in establishing its faith, its doctrine. Hello and welcome back to Shattering Myths. You can engage in this discussion with us if you call toll-free, 877-300-7645. We found that Scientific American was forced, once the evidence came in, to write a retraction of an article that, of course, they would place their belief in, which is this idea of the spontaneous creation of life and evolution from that first microorganism to the complexities that we see today. But in this article, they had to recognize that based upon the research that has been done in terms of the fossil record, that there wasn't sufficient time. So now that we understand the infrastructure of biological systems, something which Darwin was completely unaware, we know that life's mechanisms are way too complex for any of this to happen. Well, this time makes the improbable certain position was promoted for decades by leading biologists. It is still taught in today's textbooks, but it is absolutely and unequivocally untrue. Scientific American admitted as much in a special publication called The Origin and Evolution of Life. It was their first and only retraction of a Nobel laureate's writings. Quote, although stimulating, this article probably represents one of the few, very few times in his professional life when Wald has been wrong. Examine his main thesis and see. Can time form a biological cell by waiting for chance combinations of organic compounds? Well, they ask the question because they know the answer. No. Harold Morowitz, in his book Energy Flow and Biology, computed that merely to create a bacterium would require more time than the universe might ever see if chance combinations of its molecules were the only driving force. End quote. More time than the universe might ever see. Rather than dealing with a time span of 3 to 5 million years, which is when life emerged in all of its basic forms here on this planet, not once, but in all of its basic forms, all 30-some-odd on the phylum of life, but they're talking about it still remains impossible should you be dealing with the entire 14 billion year history of the universe thus far, and what could well be, if scientists are right, another 4 or 5 times that going forward. And all of that time would not be sufficient for the random chance of molecules to create life once, much less create an environment where that life has means to nourish itself, much less create life that is capable of reproducing itself, much less creating an environment where that life is capable of protecting itself. So it is impossible. It remains impossible. Scientists know it's impossible, but they can't bring themselves to the only rational conclusion that can be drawn from the evidence, from reality, which is that God created the universe and that he conceived life. When you study the Torah, that is the only rational conclusion of the evidence contained therein. And when you study science and their discoveries, that is the only rational conclusion presented therein as well. So the argument against macroevolution made by Scientific American wasn't just that there wasn't sufficient time. It was that random chance creation of a bacterium was impossible. Now that we understand the infrastructure of biological systems, as I said a moment ago, something that Darwin was completely unaware of, we know that life's mechanisms are way too complicated and too interdependent to have emerged through random chance rather than as a product of purposeful design. Therefore, the most significant problem for evolutionists, macroevolutionists, is that beneficial, more complex, and information-enhanced mutations are so uncommon, so enormously overwhelmed by detrimental alterations in propensity, those which lose or corrupt genetic information, overwhelmingly outnumber those whose beneficially augment information, that microevolution isn't just improbable, it's rationally and mathematically impossible. Plants and animals devolve, they do not evolve. That's the reality. And we're going to turn back our focus to this reality when Shattering Myths returns after the commercial break. Shattering Myths. We were considering the argument that was rationally presented by Morowitz, who said that not only was it impossible that life formed through random chance interactions of inorganic materials, that mathematically it becomes incalculable to the point of being beyond reason within the size and age of the entire universe and its future going forward, that in an area constrained to the Earth's relative size and bereft of the billions of years, that the improbable scheme was diminished to an absolute absurdity. You have to have more faith than any religious zealot to believe that life was conceived by random chance and that it mutated favorably to the conditions that we witness today. That takes vastly more faith than the faith required for a Muslim to be a suicide bomber. And yet, this faith, we apply the label of reason to, because this faith is promoted by scientists. And yet, it is a scheme that is absurdly impossible. And every scientist who has studied the material knows that it's impossible, but they won't say it's impossible other than Morowitz, because they would be drummed out of the club. You know, when you're in the business of promoting lies for a living, Pope Benedict, for example, is trapped in that milieu of promoting lies for a living, living a lie, as biological scientists are doing with the lie that is macroevolution and the spontaneous generation of life, then when someone produces evidence and reason to say that they are living a lie, that they always lash out, slandering the individual, just as a religious individual does. They cannot handle any affront to their faith. And so if you're going to be in that community, if you're going to be a research scholar, if you're going to be accepted within the community, if you're going to be a professor, even though you know for certain that the lie you are promoting, the foundational lie that you are promoting, is absurd, you'll continue to do it and you'll attack anyone who says otherwise. And this myth of the spontaneous generation of the most primitive form of life once is just the tip of the iceberg. You know, Morowitz was just telling us it's impossible that life emerged in this way. But that's the first glimmer of life, which isn't nearly enough for it to succeed. The inaugural plant would have had to locate a source of food, would have to be able to process that fortuitous source of energy in a way that was productive rather than destructive, and then would have had to find a way to reproduce itself. If the first generation of life failed to accomplish any of these enormously complex tasks, life would need more than 15 billion years and the entire universe to have even the remotest chance of starting all over again. That is why Fred Hoyle, the former and famed British astronomer, has said that the spontaneous emergence of a single cell organism from random chance couplings of chemicals was as likely as the assemblage of a 747 jet by a tornado whirling through a junkyard. Frankly, the odds aren't nearly that good, not even remotely. And at that point, you still have no one to fly your airplane, no passengers to put in your airplane, no purpose for this airplane, and no fuel for your airplane, no place to take off, and no place to land. So why are scientists still lying to us and to some extent to themselves? Why do the smartest people cling to the most foolish and disproven notion? Why have they abandoned evidence and reason with regard to life? The creation has become their god, and science has become their religion. Yahweh's concluding comment on the benefit of having established the conditions necessary for life to emerge was rather to simply understand, and God saw that it was good. God sees life as good because this life has created the environment where people have the opportunity to get to know him, to listen to what he is offering, and to choose to accept his offer. to become his children, should they choose to be, so that he can shelter them, protect them, nourish them, enable them to grow, empower and enrich them as his family throughout all time. Yet the emergence of life is only the second time the Creator has expressed satisfaction with his creation. God saw that the conception of life was good. He was also pleased by the onset of light. And indeed, light still leads to life. 3 is Yahweh's second favorite number. It represents family, especially his family, comprised of the Heavenly Father, our spiritual mother, the set-apart spirit, Yah's maternal manifestation, and the corporeal manifestation of Yah's nature, the Son, Yahusha. Yah's physical representative would be Yahusha. His spiritual representative is the set-apart spirit, and he is the head of the household, the Father. That's how he presents himself. One God, one purpose, one covenant, one teaching, one path. Therefore, historically, it should not be surprising that Yahweh established his human family at the beginning of the third millennia of human history. Abraham left Mesopotamia, the Babylon of false religion, married Sarah, and entered the promised land. Abraham chose the God-given name, Merciful Father. He formed a Bereth, family-oriented covenant relationship during this 1,000 years of human history, culminating with these things. And Yahweh gave birth to Yishak, which means laughter. He remained faithful and ultimately became the patriarch of the chosen people, a family which would serve as God's eyewitnesses, a family whose seed would ultimately save us. All of this happened on the third day. Now, having completed the third day, Yahweh's most important miracle was about to be made manifest. We have reached the dawn of the fourth millennia of human development. It is year 1,900,000,000 BCE cosmologically. Spiritually, this day predicts the events which would unfold during man's fourth millennia. Yahweh's year 3,000 to 4,000, an epoch which corresponds to 968 BCE through 33 CE on our pagan calendars, is the subject of the fourth day. It represents 1,000 years because the Catholics weren't thoughtful enough to include the year zero in the Gregorian calendar. So 968 BCE through 33 CE is actually 1,000 years, not 1,001, because there is no zero in the Gregorian calendar. You go from 1 BCE to 1 AD without a year zero, a starting point. So we're dealing now with time that commenced cosmologically 1,900,000,000 years ago, and speaking of a time in terms of man's history, 3,000 to 400 years ago, which would be 968 BCE through 33 CE, an extraordinarily important period of time. Here's the story from God's perspective. God, Elohim, Almighty, said, "Let there be lights in the expanse of the heavens to divide day from night, and let them exist as symbols and signs," oath, as signals distinguishing markers, as forms of remembrance, as nonverbal representations which have meaning, as warnings, as miraculous proof, as wondrous indications, as illustrations, examples, serving as metaphors to make something clearly known. For the appointed symbolic meeting places and times. So these lights, which are going to serve as signs, as symbols, are specifically on our behalf to designate the appointed symbolic meeting places and times, the moed, the designated periods which are related to others for a specific purpose authorized by the authority. They are for days, and they are for years. This is Bereshith in the beginning, Genesis 1:4. When words like oath and moed are inadequately translated signs and seasons, the meaning of the passage and its symbolic message is completely lost. Accurately and completely communicated, these two sentences convey the profound truth that the moed, the mikre, the designated called-out invitations to meet with God of Yahweh are wondrous signs which convey an important message from our Creator. Understand the Moed Mikre, and you will understand the purpose of God. You will understand our relationship with Him, our role in that relationship. You'll understand the means to salvation. The very framework of time itself from start to finish is all explained to those who consider the signs. These signs that lead us to the Moed, the meetings with God. Clerics and laity alike have been deceived into believing that salvation is a byproduct of grace or of jihad, and that future prophetic events cannot be dated. Yet in actuality, they are simply ignorant of the means provided on this day by God Himself to provide the means not only to our reconciliation, but to ascertain the timeline for most every significant redemptive event in human history, past, present, and future. They can all be understood by connecting the signs with the Moed, the symbols that God provided for us to meet with Him, for us to evaluate time itself. So when we return to Shattering Myths, we will analyze this day and in particular ascertain what God said and what He did not say about it. Good morning and welcome back to Shattering Myths. I am your host, Yetta. This will be the last segment of our show today, but we'll be back with you at this time tomorrow, and we'll continue this discussion. You know, when we lose track of the prophetic nature and the salvation symbolism of Yahweh's Moed Mikre, especially of Pesach Passover, of Matzah Unleavened Bread, of Bukkudim First Fruits, and Shavuah Seven Sabbaths, all which were enabled as promised, fulfilled as promised, by Yahweh through His corporeal manifestation, Yahusha, in year 4000 Yah, which was 33 CE on our pagan calendars, right at the time that we were told it would happen in the creation account. And then we also consider Teruah, trumpets, Kippurim reconciliations, and Sukkah shelters, the three yet unfulfilled Moed Mikre. We find that there is a pattern that God has performed as He promised He would, when He said He would, doing things in the precise order that He articulated. He is following the path that He has laid out before us. And yet, when Christians annul all of this, when they disregard all of this because they're living the myth that they're in this so-called New Testament, which, by the way, is based on a complete myth, the covenant has not yet been renewed, and that they can therefore discount all of this, that's when they become lost. That's when no one knows the time, because they don't know God. There's not one of them that has a relationship with Him. They don't study the playbook that He presented to us, which is His Torah. And so they are indeed clueless. When we go about replacing Yahweh's festival feasts, His Moed, with things such as Valentine's Day, St. Patrick's Day, Lent, Palm Sunday, Maundy Thursday, Good Friday, and Easter Sunday, along with the Assumption of Mary, Halloween, and Christmas, we become misled and hell-bent. That's why people are so clueless. Since the Moed Mikre embody Yahweh's seven-step plan of salvation, since they established the days and years upon which the redemptive history and all of prophecy unfold, there are few things as important as knowing that they, these Moed, these meetings, exist as symbols and signs, as signals, distinguishing markers and remembrances, as nonverbal representations which have meaning, as omens, even warnings, miraculous proof and wondrous indications, illustrations and examples, serving as metaphors, which make something more clearly known, an accounting, a recording used in an evaluation of a potential reward, of a communication mark, of a standard, of a banner, of an ensign that is at the end of an upright pole conveying the leader's message to his followers. All of this is based upon that Hebrew word of oath, the sign. It's why oath has become an English word. It is a promise. It is a statement that you claim is true. Oath. Well, in Hebrew, it is the sign, it is the symbol. And the symbol of what? God said the fourth day was the symbol of the Moed. What are the Moed? The Moed are the meetings with God. They are the Moed Mikre, the seven invitations that God has given us to meet with Him. They are symbolic of the appointed meeting times and places, for days and for years. And as you should expect by now, there is a correlation between the description of the fourth creative day and the fourth Mikra, that of seven Sabbaths. While the first three called out assembly meetings depict the means to our redemption, the fourth appointment with God features an open invitation which includes everyone. And it is during Shavua that those who have chosen to rely on the first three steps to our reconciliation, to our redemption, to our immortality, to our adoption into the covenant that Yahweh has provided by Pesach and Matzah, where we become immortal, where we are perfected, and Bokorim, where we are adopted into His family on Shavua, the fourth of these Moed, that we are enriched with His Torah teaching, His guidance, and we are empowered by His Spirit. All of this is so necessary for our meeting with God. It's why it's all included as a reference, as a sign and symbol of the fourth day. We'll return to this message tomorrow.
Hi, I'm Dr. Joel Wallach, the Dead Doctors Don't Lie guy. There's no reason why you shouldn't live to be at least 100 and have a great time getting there. And I'm going to give you a free copy.